You know the drill. If it's Sunday, it's time to check in with our master of good cheer and insightful political and military analysis, the irrepressible Yakov Katz. He's rebounded from the flu and in fine fettle. Today, we get into the very critical juncture Israel seems to have arrived at in its relationship with the United States. President Biden has been a stalwart ally, but we have seen very sharp signs in recent days in particular of his growing exasperation in dealing with what he clearly regards as a recalcitrant Prime Minister Netanyahu. With the war now entering its sixth month, things seem stuck. Israel is sinking in a morass of indecision. Rafah, hostages, aid fiascos. More than ever, we desperately need clear, focused, and strong leadership. But the main players in the dysfunctional Israeli coalition and war cabinet seem to be mired in muck. Treading water, as Yaakov puts it. Barely, I say. The hostages languish. Qatar is losing patience with its Hamas protégés and pressing them to make a deal already. But Hamas leader and October 7th mastermind, Yahya Sinwar, is holed up in the tunnels, using hostages as human shields, and determined to wait it out. He believes that he will force Israel to withdraw fully from the Gaza Strip and bring the mighty IDF to its knees. We discuss the plight of the hostages, a possible assault on Rafah, American solutions for humanitarian aid, and speculate that this roiling tension between America and Israel will come to a head in the coming week. Spoiler alert, we were both wrong in predicting that the past week would be dominated by the controversial draft bill in Israel. But the issue was resurrected on Saturday night by the chief Sephardic rabbi, who said that if forced to serve in the military, he would counsel all his followers to leave Israel. Oi, welcome back for another raucous rundown of life in Israel. I'm Vivian Berkovich, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and now living in the beautiful, balmy state of Tel Aviv. Stay with us. Morning, Yaakov. How are you today?
Good morning, Vivian.
How was your weekend? It's restorative?
Always good to have a break from the craziness of this country and the life that we all live here.
Yeah, to unplug, as we say. But now we're back into the week. Sunday is the beginning of the week in Israel, and we have a lot to talk about today, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do indeed.
No shortage this week, although no shortage any week, to be honest. But yeah.
I want to start with, I love the come to Jesus moment. Thursday evening at the end of the State of the Union address, President Biden says he's going to be having a come to Jesus moment soon with Bibi about aid to Gaza.
To be having a come to Jesus moment with Netanyahu and more generally just about the progress and the war and everything that's going on. Yeah.
What do you think of that? I mean, I don't know what to do with that. First of all, I have to say we're going to get to Hamas and Qatar also having their come to Jesus moment. And I just love all of the inappropriate metaphors. But let's stick with Biden and Bibi for now.
Biden, to his credit, he then gave an interview on NBC, I think it was, and he explained that come to Jesus moment is a phrase from the southern part of his state, right? I guess in South Delaware, this is how they talk, whatever. But what he was, and he was asked specifically about the comment and what exactly frustrates him about Netanyahu. And I'll say that it was probably the harshest comments that the president has made about Israel and definitely about the prime minister since the beginning of this war. Basically saying that Netanyahu is failing his own country and saying that he is leading his country in the wrong way, that Netanyahu cannot go on and continue to just kill Palestinians as if that's all we're doing in this war in Gaza. On the other hand, he did say that he would never leave Israel to stand and have to defend itself by itself and that America would always be there. So it was a little more nuanced, but it was very critical. And I think we're all watching in real time how the U.S. support of Israel is changing and the relationship here is evolving in a way that maybe we could have avoided with different things that we would have done on the Israeli government side, We could maybe talk about that. But the fact of the matter is that things are now different between Israel and the U.S. And we have to recognize that as we contemplate future steps in this war.
And I think that a lot of the reason that the relationship between the two countries is changing so significantly is really rooted in personal conflicts. Personal conflicts between Prime Minister Netanyahu and a succession of presidents on the other side. There is a pattern here, no?
Yeah, I mean, listen, this isn't new, right? Anyone who's watched and followed Netanyahu over, it's now 17 years pretty much as Prime Minister of Israel in his three different stints, right? 2 years in the 90s, or three, actually more, you're right. It's 3 years in the 90s, 96 to 99, 09 till pretty much now, except for 1 year in the middle. It's been a long time.
I think he's around the 20 mark, but we won't fuss over the details. It's a long time.
A long time. And he does this with every president that he works with. He did it with Clinton. He did it with Obama. And we all know how he went into Obama's house pretty much and told him there was the lecture in the White House. There was the speech at Congress. He's doing this again with Biden. This is the MO, right? This is how he operates.
You skipped over Trump. You skipped over Trump. He even managed to alienate Trump.
I think he genuinely thought that he was controlling Trump to a large extent, right, while Trump was president. But it was less tense then than it is now. I think you saw that tension with Clinton in the 90s. You saw that tension definitely during the 8 years of Obama. And you're seeing that play out again now. And there's things that he could do. You know, I'll tell you what kind of drives me a little crazy is, let's say, hypothetically speaking, Netanyahu had a few weeks ago, or maybe now 2 months ago, started to say, when the day after plan started to be thought about, started to say, listen, obviously Hamas needs to be removed and we're all aligned on that, but the Palestinian Authority is going to be our best option, although they have problems. So we can't really embrace them now, but here's the roadmap for how the Palestinian Authority can really become a legitimate partner: reforms, elections, no corruption anymore, cancel pay for slave laws, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But mentions those words, Palestinian Authority, right? Starts to work with the U.S., I think we would have a different reality right now. I'm not saying embrace the Palestinian Authority. I'm saying embrace a reformed Palestinian Authority. But he couldn't even do that, right? He always prioritizes his coalition and his political survival in that moment over everything else. And Israel now is seeing the result of that.
What else do you think he could have done differently with respect to aid and providing aid to the Gaza Strip that may not have stoked President Biden's ire in quite the way it has?
I got to be honest, though. I'll tell you something about the whole aid situation is I also have a bit of a problem with the whole aid situation, because I think it's a little, obviously there are displaced people in Gaza, there are civilians in Gaza, and they are suffering. But I don't know that from day one that we're transferring an aid and fuel and all this, and we're supposed to facilitate. This is meant to, you know, you want to fight an enemy, and at the same time, you're supposed to be feeding the enemy, is a little strange. I don't think America would ever behave that way and do something like that on its own. But of course, they can demand that of us. But whatever, regardless of that, we needed to find a better mechanism from the beginning to work in a more coordinated way with the United States. And we didn't do that either. It was all very resistful from the beginning. And I think that we could have, for example, insisting on aid only coming in from the south in the beginning, and then finally we let it go in through the north in a not really calculated or coordinated way. We had the disaster with the truck and that convoy about a week and a half ago. Now the Americans are talking about creating a floating port off the, I mean, like, things are really getting out of hand here. They really are. And I'll just say one other thing, Vivian, on this point. We're a bit stuck. I think we have to be honest for a moment. We're treading water at the moment in the war. We're a bit stuck. We're still in Khan Yunis. Now we're in another neighborhood in Khan Yunis, but Khan Yunis is okay. That was yesterday's news. We've been hearing about Rafah, Rafah, Rafah. We've been hearing about maybe a deal, maybe a deal. But we should be deciding what we want. And it's never good. This moment in time when you get stuck, as happens in, unfortunately, every war that Israel fights, is the point that you also begin to lose the support. And we're at that point now. I think it's just obvious to me.
Yeah, I think that it's pretty obvious to most people paying attention. And I don't even know if we're treading. I think we're starting to go under, but I don't want to be the pessimist here. But you did bring up the pier, And that's something that's been talked about a lot over the last week since 100 or possibly more Palestinians were either shot or stampeded to death or driven over by trucks. We'll never really, I don't think, have a clear answer about exactly what happened there. But Palestinians died scrambling for aid. And since that time, America has been very focused on finding an alternate way to deliver aid to civilians in the Gaza Strip. And now the talk seems to be focusing on a floating pier off the Gaza Strip so that ships can dock. Yeah. They don't want to keep, they've been dropping, airdropping.
Parachuting in aid, yeah.
Exactly, parachuting in aid. Sometimes the parachutes don't open. People get killed when the aid boxes hit the ground. There's all kinds of problems with parachuting aid. So now we're moving to a floating pier. What do you think of that solution? It's going to take a few months to
build. They're talking about it's going to take at least 60 days till this thing gets up and running. I'm hoping that by 60 days, we'll have some clarity on what the hell's going on, because that's part of the issue here. I think that the floating pier is a nice idea, and if the Americans can pull it off, great. I think that what we're seeing here is Israel's losing control of the situation, right? And we need some big brother to come in and take control. And that's the bigger story that's happening here, right? The Americans have to come in and they have to build this floating pier. The Americans have to go parachute in aid. The Americans have to tell us whether we should go into Rafah or we shouldn't go into Rafah. Israel, again, is falling behind on leading the conversation and leading policy here. And I'm not going to pretend that things are simple. They're not. This is extremely complicated. But part of the way that you do continue to control is by constantly setting the narrative and creating prospects for where things are going. And we're failing to do that. We're failing to outline what we want. We're failing to, we just talk about, we want to continue, ultimate victory. These are slogans that mean absolutely nothing. And this is maybe what Biden's referring to with his come to Jesus moment with Netanyahu. It's time to get real, man, and to start to talk about what's happening.
Yeah. And it was interesting last night. I'm sure you probably saw the same discussions on the Saturday night TV talk fest. Really, actually, they just yell at each other. But I was watching Channel 12 and I saw a lot of yelling and a lot of disagreement and a lot of senior cabinet ministers from the government trying to explain why it was wrong for Benny Gantz to go to the U.S. What do you think about that? Because that's part of this problem, isn't it? This breakdown of leadership, this failure of leadership, and the fact that we have Benny Gantz, leader of the opposition, going to America, Bibi and his coalition government pissed off about that and just sending little political daggers to undermine Benny and undermine Israel's standing and undermine any potential progress that can be made in terms of, as you're saying, showing the way, taking charge.
The Benny Gantz thing, I'll say, I see both sides. In other words, on the one hand, you have an opportunity to go to Washington, to meet with the highest level of leadership in the U.S., this vice president, secretary of state, defense, et cetera, to go to London and meet with the prime minister and the foreign secretary, all very important at a time of war. You're the highest ranking member of the war cabinet after the prime minister, right? And in a normal world, the prime minister and his member of cabinet would be coordinated and would be sending messages and working together. Now, this is anything but the normal world. And let's also be honest for a moment, Benny Gantz sees an opportunity to make up his own political move, right? He's in the government, but he's also posturing and he wants to show the Israeli public, hey, I can go to Washington and London and get those high-level meetings, just like Netanyahu. I get that. On the other hand, I think it is damaging to some extent because you are allowing yourself to become a bit of a political football. You know that you're getting the meetings because the Americans, for example, want to outshine Bibi and they want to show that they're going to work with you and they want to show that they like you more than they like Netanyahu. And you're allowing yourself and the war also to be used for political purposes. So Benny Gantz, come on. I thought you're the guy who's not supposed to be political. You're the guy who always puts the good of the country first. Was this really the good of the country? So I do think that there are two sides to this. I think they're both to blame. Both Benjamins, Benjamin Netanyahu and Benjamin Gantz, are, let's be honest, this coalition that they're in together, this is no coalition. This is a government that is barely functioning, a war cabinet where the members despise one another, literally. Even Yoav Gallant, who's from Likud, the defense minister, is barely on speaking terms with the prime minister. The prime minister and Benny Gantz are barely on speaking terms. Gadi Eisenkot is not hiding his criticism. This is not a good place for the country to be at a time of war, right? We're in war.
Okay, and hang on. So notwithstanding all your criticisms and on the one hand, on the other hand, Benny is taking an opportunity to at least go and speak to them. Yes, he's politicking. Yes, he's working to burnish his foreign policy diplomatic credentials, which are not the best. But he's doing it and he's going and he's talking. And Netanyahu is sabotaging. As you say, we're in a war. Shouldn't we just get on with it?
We should definitely get on with it. And the two of these people, the Benny and Bibi, should either decide to split or decide to get their act together. I think that from my perspective, Benny Gantz, he's totally playing politics here, right? The only reason that he's so high up in the polls is because he has created this image of somebody who doesn't play politics and puts the country first. So he's climbed in the polls. He's playing politics staying in this government. He doesn't want to leave because he doesn't want to go down in the polls. And he knows the moment he leaves, he goes down. So come on, let's all wake up and be mature about this. Either we're at war and we're having a wartime coalition and we're putting everything aside, which means also that we're going to use Benny Gantz's ability to access Kamala Harris. And we're going to use the fact that they're both in the government to create some policy. But instead, let's say this very clearly. This government is failing, and it's failing in setting policy, and it's also failing in managing this country and pretending to put on an image of a government that is putting the country before its own political interests.
Throw me a nugget. Throw me
positive?
Something. Yeah.
You're putting me on the spot here. It's hard to see one right now. I got to be honest, because I'm just overtaken by all the political games that are being played by both sides here. And I'm overtaken by something we haven't spoken about, but my lack of confidence and expectation that something fundamental is going to change in this country in the aftermath of this war, which I think needs to, but I don't see that coming. And I just don't see that we're making any of those moves in that direction.
And that's been my feeling since October 8th. For the life of me, I appreciate that once you've declared war, it's not the best time for a change in leadership, never mind an election. But people should have demanded that Netanyahu and a few others in the top spots in the IDF step aside. Someone else can come up. We didn't need to change the government. We didn't need for the government. It wasn't necessary for the government to fall. Netanyahu steps aside. The government remains intact. Someone else steps into the prime minister's chair on an acting basis to lead the country in wartime. And what we have, and I thought this on October 8th, is the same people who made the terrible decisions that got us into this mess that was eminently avoidable. And they continue to make the same bad decisions. And they continue to compound this mess. And I'm just agreeing with you. I just think,
yeah, why should things be different? It's the same people. This is it's a plague, and it's something that has to be called out. And we have to recognize that there is a fundamental root change that needs to take place in this country. And we're not doing the work. No, we're not. I have zero confidence in any of these people who I see right now who are coming up in the Knesset, whether it's Benny Gantz, whether it's Netanyahu, whether it's the people who are waiting on the wings, the Naftali Bennett's and Yossi Cohen's. And I listened to Yossi Cohen's interview just the other day on another podcast, although there are no other podcasts out there, but on another podcast, people are urging him to go into politics. And he said, it's not about me. And it's, come on. Seriously, are you really think people aren't falling for this stuff? What's going on here?
I heard from so many people, and I expect you did too, in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, we've got to completely flush out the old leadership, all of them. Everybody has to go and basically reinvent, recreate the civic environment in this country. And I kept saying, and how's that going to happen? It'll happen. You'll see. As I expected, here we are.
Are you concerned with what is going on in Israel? This is not just another crisis. State of Tel Aviv is committed to delivering superb and candid analysis, and we're offering a limited-time subscription special a 33% discount from the regular fee of $90 annually. 1 year for only $60. Stay informed and stay connected with State of Tel Aviv. We are a reader-supported enterprise. If you value our work, please subscribe. It makes a huge difference. stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. Now, back to the podcast.
Okay, let's now move to the other come to Jesus moment. I am not from Joe Biden's part of Delaware, but it's an expression I've long used. I love it. And the come to Jesus moment between Qatar and Hamas, such as it is, I've seen Qatar is, of course, the largest financial and state sponsor of Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, the Houthis. They throw money at these groups. They clearly promote their Islamist aims, and they provide a home base in Doha for three of the top leaders of Hamas. So it's just fascinating to watch them use the October 7th crisis and the hostage crisis in particular as an opportunity to pull out their Savile Row suits and buff up and present a very dignified, moderate face to the world. They're going to be the mediators between Hamas and Israel and negotiate these staged hostage releases. But it seems that even Qatar has lost a lot of its influence with and control over Hamas. We've been hearing rumblings of this for a while, but what we're hearing now is that Sinwar was incommunicado for a week or so, probably over the last couple of weeks. He's now been back in communication. This is his Stalingrad. He's not going anywhere. He's staying in the tunnels. He figures he's outflanked and outwitted Israel. Israel's going to have to bow to his demands and fully withdraw from Gaza in order to see any hostages. And even Qatar is now saying, come on. And the guys in Doha, the Hamas guys in Doha, are saying they want to make a deal, but Sinwar refuses. The Qatari government is now threatening to expel the Hamas leaders that are given safe haven and refuge there. So what does this all mean, Yaakov? What's going on between Qatar and Hamas? And what does this mean for the hostages?
Look, we know that there's a lot of talk of a possible deal, and that's been going on for some time now. The president himself was even asked about that, how Ramadan begins tonight, and everyone was trying to aim to reach a deal before Ramadan. Does not seem that there's a deal. On the other hand, we know that the CIA director Burns was in the region. I think it was Jordan. And the Mossad chief flew there to meet with him, Dedi Barnea. So those talks are ongoing. And there's a lot of coordination. And there are still attempts to reach that deal. We also know that Hamas has not yet given a favorable answer. So it's if these reports are true, it seems that Doha is the Qataris are starting to take a tougher stance when it comes to Hamas and possibly even threatening to expel them. This is all very possible, but let's not forget that I take that all with a grain of salt. The Qataris have been playing a double game for a long time, right? And part of their game is that on the one hand, they are the people who give refuge and allow Qatar to be the playground for these different terrorist leaders. And on the other hand, they pretend to be the only ones that can actually talk to them. Of course, you're the only ones who can talk to them because you're paying them money and you're letting them live in your country. So there has been pressure on the Qataris to take a tougher position with the Hamas leaders. Is now the time that they're doing that? Maybe not. Don't know. We saw the prime minister of Qatar, who was in Washington just this past week, meeting with Secretary Blinken. Lots of positive comments by the Americans regarding the Qatari role so far. We got to hope that there is actually some movement there because these hostages, as we've spoken many times, do have to come home.
Do you think they will?
I hope so. I hope so. And I think there is a deal that's on the table that I think Israel would be willing to accept right now. And by the way, with everything that we said before about the tension with the Americans, there is one positive there. You asked me for that nugget. Now it just came to me. The Americans have been saying that Israel is the one that has said yes to the deal and that it's Hamas that has. Now, imagine if it was us who were saying no to the deal. Now, is this just a smart move by Israel to say yes because we know that Hamas is going to say no? Who knows? But the fact of the matter is that we have agreed to the deal that's been put on the table that includes a six-week ceasefire in Gaza. I think the fact that we have yet to go into Rafah shows that we're holding out for a deal. So we want a deal. And we have to hope that Hamas comes and recognizes there's an opportunity and let's get this deal done and let's get our people home.
I really hope that that's what we're talking about next week. We're going to wrap up with our predictions. We started last week with predicting what's going to dominate the news here in the coming week. And last week we said it was going to be the issue of the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredim in Israel, refusing to be drafted into the
IDF.
And
I was wrong up until Saturday night. So I got the whole week wrong, except for one night where I got right.
In fairness, we were both wrong. But you also predicted that Bibi would find a way around the crisis. That, of course, is now in abeyance. So tell us what happened last night.
Not much going on with the draft bill all week, except for suddenly on Saturday night, as Shabbat comes to an end, the Sephardic chief rabbi, Yitzchak Yosef, gives his Saturday night weekly class, Shir. And in it, he says that we will not draft. And if they force us to draft, we will leave the country and we will move en masse abroad, which prompted me to tweet in response. I am happy to pay. I offered to volunteer to pay for his one-way ticket. And I there wouldn't be nothing that would make me happier is to help fund his departure from Israel. I have to say that I got a lot of positive responses to that, but I did get a lot of negative. People accused me of being an anti-Semite, which I don't really understand how, but whatever. Put that aside.
I liked it. I liked the tweet, but I don't think that he's going to be drafted. I think it's the young'uns.
Correct. No, yeah. I just want to get rid of people like him who are just bring no good to this country. But it has to be said, that comment was horrific. And it came the same day that a senior officer was killed in Gaza. Happens to be the first cousin of Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich. Seems to really have been a really incredible person, a teacher and a commander. Ben Avisar is his last name. Smotrich even tweeted against the chief rabbi and said, at a time like this, these comments do us no good. Look, we're facing a real issue here. I do think that the draft thing is still there. I don't know if it's going to be the main topic of the week, but it's still there. It's behind. It's out.
It looms. It looms.
It looms large.
Very large. Okay, so what's your prediction for this week? What's going to dominate?
I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to say that the big issue is this collision that we're in right now with the Americans, and that's going to be in the headlines a lot in the coming week, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
All right, that's vague enough that I think you actually might be right.
I'm being more careful this time, right? I don't want to take too precise an issue. No, but even specifically, listen, if you listen to the Biden interview on NBC, and he's asked about maybe even coming to Israel and speaking before the Knesset, and he doesn't rule that out. There's apparently a lot going on behind the scenes here of him again contemplating another trip, coming to the Knesset, appealing directly to the Israeli people, bypassing the leadership, doing to Bibi what Bibi did to Obama back in 2015. There's some interesting things that are going on. So I think that this is going to be with us for some time now.
Never a dull moment. Thank you so much, Yaakov, as always, for helping to tease it apart and make sense of the chaos. Have a great week.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Vivian.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the State of Tel Aviv and Beyond podcast. We'll keep the dispatches coming as frequently as we can. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment, rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can check out our full library of articles and podcasts at our website, stateoftelaviv.com. State of Tel Aviv is an independent media venture, and we rely on subscribers to support our work. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, please consider taking the plunge today. Each person really does make a huge difference, especially in these very challenging times in Israel. It is important that you stay informed and current and seek out a range of perspectives. This is a pivotal moment in Israeli history. It is not a time to be passive and disengaged. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm Vivian Berkovich, signing off from deep inside the State of Tel Aviv.